We would like to send out a special thanks to HelloFresh for supporting The Trail Went Cold. HelloFresh lets you just cook, eat, and enjoy. Go to HelloFresh.com/cold10 and use code COLD10 during HelloFresh's New Year's sale for 10 free meals, including free shipping. Thank you, and enjoy the episode.
April 8th, 2017. Washington, D.C. Police announced the arrest of 51-year-old Jose Rodriguez Cruz after charging him with first-degree murder. 8 years earlier, Jose's former girlfriend, 47-year-old Pamela Butler, vanished from her home, and while her body had still not been found, investigators were able to build up a strong enough case against Jose to pursue murder charges. This would mark the first time that a cold case featured on The Trail Went Cold was solved. But it would not be the last. Over the past 3 years, a number of cases from the podcast have either been solved or featured some very significant developments. After that, the trail did not go cold. So I guess you could say, update.
Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome to our first official Trail Went Cold episode of 2020. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and we're going to be kicking off the year by doing something a little different from the norm. If you grew up watching Unsolved Mysteries, you'll probably remember the thrill of tuning in and hearing Robert Stack utter the iconic word, update, before he shared a new development in a case which had been featured on the show. Well, that's exactly what we're going to do on this very special update episode of The Trail Went Cold. But first, I just wanted to make mention of the person who narrated our intro. That is none other than Canadian actress Gunya D. O'Horn, who hails from my current hometown of Ottawa, Ontario. Gunya D. O., who is often referred to as D.O., has a number of film and television credits to her name, including the Netflix horror series Hemlock Grove, the Amazon series, The Man in the High Castle, the recent remake of Death Wish, and she currently plays the character Tannis on the popular Canadian sitcom Letterkenny. I first learned that Dio was a major fan of The Trail Went Cold a couple years ago when she tweeted a photo of herself in the dentist chair saying that my podcast was helping her get through a root canal. She recently expressed her interest in making an appearance on the show, so I asked if she wanted to narrate the opening of this special episode. It also turns out that Dio actually hosts a podcast of her own called Coffee with My Ma, and I will be telling you more about it near the end of this episode. Anyway, the event which Dio described in the opening was a very special moment, as it marked the first time that there was a major development in a case which was featured on The Trail Went Cold. When I started this podcast nearly 4 years ago, I thought it would be cool if at least one of the cold cases I explored on the show wound up being solved, but my expectations have been greatly surpassed, and we're going to be talking about developments which have taken place in quite a few of these cases. I always have listeners ask me if I'm going to provide updates, but this situation is now occurring with such frequency that I thought the ideal way to handle it would be to go over all these updates together in the same episode. A few of the cases I've covered are now 100% solved, while others still have a long way to go, but I think it's worth discussing all of the interesting developments I have witnessed. So without any further ado, let us now begin The Trail Went Cold's very special update episode. On January the 11th, 2017, our podcast released Minisode number 10, which covered the bizarre disappearance of 47-year-old Pamela Butler, who mysteriously vanished from her home in Washington, D.C. On Valentine's Day in 2009, Pam was supposed to take her mother out to dinner, but she never showed up, and after visiting her house, Pam's family discovered that she was missing. The most baffling aspect of this mystery was that Pam's house was covered by 24-hour security cameras, but while the surveillance footage showed her entering the house on February the 12th, it did not show her leaving. So how exactly did Pam disappear? Well, suspicion immediately turned to Pam's 44-year-old boyfriend, Jose Rodriguez Cruz, as the security footage showed him entering and exiting the house on multiple occasions. Jose claimed that Pam broke up with him on the evening of February 12th, and while he kept returning to the house over the next few days to pick up his stuff, he maintained that Pam was not there at that time, and he had no idea what happened to her. While there was no direct evidence that a crime had been committed, and if Jose did kill Pam, how did he manage to get her body out of the house without being captured by the security cameras? This would remain a cold case for 8 years, but on April the 8th, 2017, less than 3 months after the release of our minisode, the DC police announced that Jose had been arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Even though Pam's body had still not been found, a veteran homicide detective named Michael Fulton had recently been assigned to the case and put together enough circumstantial evidence against Jose to make an arrest. Just over 1 month later, I recorded and released a very brief update minisode about this new development, even though only a limited amount of information had been released publicly at that point. However, this case would never go to trial, because in October of that year, Jose and the prosecution agreed to a plea deal in which he would plead guilty to second-degree murder. Jose finally confessed to killing Pam at her house, claiming that they got into a heated argument about his unemployment, which prompted him to attack Pam and strangle her to death. He then proceeded to place Pam's body inside a trash bag and smuggled it out of the house through the dining room windows. The only reason this did not show up on the surveillance footage was because these windows were a blind spot, not covered by the security cameras, and being a frequent guest at the house, Jose would have known this. Jose then said he proceeded to drive Pam's body to Stafford County, Virginia, where he buried her in a wooded area on the median strip between the northbound and southbound lanes of Interstate 95. As part of his plea deal, Jose would agree to lead police to the location of Pam's remains, and in exchange, he would receive a 12-year prison sentence. In December, a search effort was performed of the aforementioned median strip on I-95. This involved the use of cadaver dogs, whose reactions seemed to indicate that human remains were probably buried there, but a lot of construction work had been performed at this location over the previous 8 years. Much of the area had been paved over in order to build some new express lanes, so unfortunately, the police concluded that Pam's remains were likely unrecoverable. Since Pam's family cannot even give her a proper burial, I'm sure it now feels extra unfair that Jose only has to serve 12 years for killing her, but this story is far from over. Believe it or not, during their investigation into Pam's disappearance, police discovered that Jose may have been responsible for the disappearance of another woman 2 decades earlier. In fact, this case has become so convoluted that it wound up being featured on an episode of Dateline titled The Golden Child, which aired in March of 2019. One of the reasons police felt comfortable arresting Jose without a body was because they uncovered an extensive history of domestic violence against multiple women, including 2 ex-wives. In 1989, Jose was estranged from his first wife, 26-year-old Marta Heidi Rodriguez, but on March 29th, he confronted Marta outside her house. Jose attempted to force her into his car, but a police officer just happened to be in the area and intervened. Jose was arrested, charged with abduction, and released on bond, but the case was eventually dismissed when Marta failed to show up in court to testify against him on May the 18th. 1 week later, Marta's roommate officially reported her missing. Naturally, there was a lot of suspicion about Jose, but a surprising development took place in October of 2000 when Marta was discovered to be alive and well and living in Miami-Dade County, Florida. After she was formally interviewed by police, the case was closed, but there was only one problem. This woman was not actually Marta. You see, when Jose got remarried, he learned that his sister-in-law was an undocumented immigrant, so he convinced her to go along with a scheme in which she would take over Marta's identity. Jose provided her with Marta's social security number and date of birth, and she impersonated Marta when police showed up to interview her in 2000. This was just one of the many shocking revelations uncovered about Jose's background when Detective Michael Fulton took over the investigation into Pam's disappearance. Jose and Marta also had a son together who would become a key witness in the case and provided information which helped lead to Jose's arrest. While growing up, Jose's son witnessed a number of violent outbursts from his father and lived in constant fear of him. At one point, the son claimed he found a note his father had written which read, quote, "I, Jose Angel Rodriguez Cruz, am responsible for Marta's disappearance," end quote. Naturally, when Jose was arrested for Pam's murder, the investigation into Marta's disappearance was reopened. In June of 2018, it was announced that Marta's skeletal remains had been found on a median strip of Interstate 95 in Stafford County, Virginia, only a few miles away from the location where Jose claimed Pam's remains were buried. The remains were originally discovered in February of 1991, but kept in storage for 17 years until new DNA testing positively identified them as belonging to Marta. Finally, on October the 18th, 2019, the Stafford County Commonwealth's attorney announced that they were indicting Jose Rodriguez Cruz with first-degree murder for killing Marta. At the moment, authorities have not revealed what new evidence compelled them to charge Jose with this crime, so we will have to wait and see what happened. But while it may seem disappointing that Jose is only serving 12 years for murdering Pam, if he is eventually convicted of Marta's murder, then this ensures that he will probably never get out of prison. Anyway, now let's move on to our next solved case, another crime which happened to take place around Valentine's Day. On February the 14th, 2018, I released episode number 59, which covered two cold cases which occurred on Valentine's Day. One of them involved the murder of a 39-year-old woman named Jodine Sarin, who went by the name Jody, and this easily ranks as one of the most horrific crimes ever covered on the podcast. The victim lived in Carlsbad, California, and suffered from a mental disability, but she still led a very productive and independent life. Jody's parents, Art and Lois Sarin, purchased a condo for her to live in, though they would still check in on her on a daily basis. On Valentine's Day in 2007, the Sarins could not reach Jody by phone, so they stopped by her condo and went inside when she failed to answer the door. When Art checked the bedroom, he saw what appeared to be a man having sex with Jody on top of the bed. Art told the man to get dressed and leave while he and Lois waited in the living room, but after several minutes, Jody had still not joined them. Art went back to the bedroom and was horrified to discover that his daughter had been beaten and strangled to death. Even worse, it turned out that Art had unknowingly walked in on Jody's killer, raping her dead body. The man managed to slip out of the condo before the Sarins figured out what happened, but Art got a good look at his face, and more importantly, the man left his DNA behind. The DNA failed to match anyone in the national database, but thankfully, this episode was released only 2 months before an event which would become a major turning point in cold case investigations. I'm talking about the arrest of 72-year-old Joseph James DeAngelo, who would be positively identified as the Golden State Killer, one of the worst serial killers of all time. I'm sure you already know the details of that case, but the Golden State Killer's last known crime had taken place over 3 decades earlier, and I'm sure many people believed he would never be caught. But DeAngelo's arrest was made possible through forensic genealogy, as the Golden State Killer's DNA was uploaded to the genealogy website GEDmatch, which happened to contain DNA profiles for some of DeAngelo's distant relatives. Once they were able to narrow down DeAngelo as the prime suspect, investigators obtained DNA samples which belonged to him, and when they were compared to the Golden State Killer's DNA, a conclusive match was made. Well, this wound up opening the floodgates, and ever since then, forensic genealogy has been used as a tool to close several cold cases, many of which were decades old and once considered to be unsolvable. In some of these cases, The person arrested for the crime had never even popped up on the radar as a potential suspect. So while all this was going on, I started thinking about all the cases I'd covered on The Trail Went Cold and figuring out which ones might have had the best chance of being solved through forensic genealogy. Well, one of the very first ones I thought of was Jodine Sarin, because they had the perpetrator's DNA. Sure enough, on November the 13th, 2018, it was announced that Jodie's murder had been solved because forensic genealogy was used to identify the perpetrator as a man named David Mabrito. In fact, according to the DNA evidence, the odds of anyone else being the perpetrator were 1 in 64 quintillion. To put that into perspective, a quintillion has 18 zeros. But there would not be an arrest here, because it turned out Mabrito had been deceased for nearly 8 years as he took his own life in January of 2011 at the age of 42. We'll probably never know how this guy crossed paths with Jody and what motivated him to commit such an horrific crime, but I can't help but wonder if guilt could have played a role in his suicide. While it's disappointing that Mabrito never faced justice for the murder, one of the best things about forensic genealogy is that it makes it possible to conclusively identify a suspect even after they're already deceased. Otherwise, I'm not sure if Jody's killer ever would have been identified. One important thing to note about both this case and Pamela Butler's murder is that both of Jody's parents and Pam's mother were in their 80s when these crimes got solved. They had each expressed their concern that they would not live long enough to see a resolution to their daughters' murders, so while the experience must have been emotional for them, at least they were able to receive some form of closure while they were still alive. Anyway, since we're still on the subject of forensic genealogy, not only has it played a major role in solving crimes, but it has also been a breakthrough for cases involving unidentified decedents. Thanks in large part to a non-profit organization called the DNA Doe Project, some very prominent John and Jane Does, including Lyle Stevick, Joseph Newton Chandler III, and Buckskin Girl, have finally been identified and gotten their real names back. Just over a year ago, I released a Q&A episode where I answered a question about which cases featured on The Trail Went Cold had the best chance of being solved in 2019. One of my top picks was a case involving an unidentified Jane Doe known only as Orange Socks. On Halloween in 1979, the nude body of a young woman was found in a concrete culvert alongside Interstate 95 in Williamson County, Texas. She had been sexually assaulted and strangled to death, and since the only clothing she had on was a pair of orange socks, that became her new nickname. I featured her story on episode number 93, which was released in October of 2018, and literally days before the episode came out, the DNA Doe Project announced they were taking on her case. Given their enormous success rate, I figured there was a very good chance of the victim being identified sometime in the near future. Well, sure enough, in August of 2019, the DNA Doe Project announced that Orange Socks had officially been identified as 23-year-old Deborah Jackson. And thankfully, we can now finally start referring to her by her real name, rather than the socks she was wearing. The major break in the case occurred when Deborah Jackson's sister saw a composite sketch of the Jane Doe and noticed a resemblance. She subsequently contacted law enforcement, and DNA testing soon confirmed that she was related to the victim. Deborah's story seems very similar to a number of the other John and Jane Does who have been identified in recent years. She originally hailed from Abilene, Texas, and the last time she was seen by her family was when she left home in 1977. Even though they never heard from her again, Deborah's family never officially reported her missing because she often went off on her own, and they just figured she had started a new life somewhere and had no reason to believe she had been murdered. As unusual as that may sound today, this sort of thing was not uncommon during this time period. If a young person disappeared during the 1970s, and there was no direct evidence of foul play, it was usually very difficult to even get law enforcement to file a missing persons report. Investigators have discovered that Deborah was employed at a Ramada Inn in Amarillo and also worked at an assisted living facility in the town of Azle in 1978, though the circumstances of how she wound up murdered 1 year later are still unknown. While it's nice that Deborah Jackson has finally gotten her name back, figuring out the identity of the person who murdered her is a lot more complicated. Some of you may have recently watched the true crime series The Confession Killer, which was released on Netflix less than a month before this episode's release. It chronicles the story of serial killer Henry Lee Lucas, who gained notoriety by confessing to hundreds of murders, the vast majority of which he likely did not commit. Well, the most controversial case associated with Lucas is probably this one. Back when Deborah was still an unidentified Jane Doe, Lucas confessed that he picked her up hitchhiking before he killed her. He went on trial for the murder in 1984, where he was found guilty and received the death penalty. The problem is that there was ample evidence, including a timesheet and a signed paycheck, which showed that Lucas was in Jacksonville, Florida, on the day of the crime. While there was little doubt Lucas was guilty of other murders and deserved to be in prison, Deborah's murder was the only one in which he was sentenced to death, so the idea of executing him for a crime he did not commit was problematic. So in 1998, then-Texas Governor George W. Bush decided that there was enough reasonable doubt to halt Lucas's execution and commuted his sentence to life imprisonment. However, Lucas never was officially exonerated of the crime before he died in prison just under 3 years later. Well, since it now seems impossible for Lucas to have been responsible for Deborah's murder, there has been a renewed effort to find a real killer. In fact, last year, the Williamson County Sheriff's Office announced that DNA profiles from at least two males have been recovered from Deborah's orange socks, which opens up the question of whether more than one person was involved in the murder. Additional DNA testing is also being performed on fingernail scrapings and pubic hair samples. Investigators have never officially confirmed or denied if Henry Lee Lucas is still a suspect in this case, but given the compelling evidence which placed him in another state at the time of the murder, I'd be willing to bet anything that none of the male DNA will match him. So while this case is not 100% completely solved yet, there's a good chance that Deborah's killer or killers may be identified sometime in the near future. And now we're going to talk about another Jane Doe who may get her name back soon. One of the earliest cases that I covered on this podcast was the story of the El Dorado Jane Doe, which was the subject of episode number 8 way back in May of 2016. Unlike the previous case, there was no mystery about who the killer was, as a young woman was shot by her ex-boyfriend, James McAlphin, at a motel in El Dorado, Arkansas, on July 10, 1991. McAlphin was soon apprehended and would plead guilty to second-degree murder, for which he received a 15-year prison sentence. McAlphin and everyone else who knew the victim believed her name was Mercedes, but she was actually carrying around identification with the name Cheryl Ann Wick, and it turned out Mercedes had stolen another woman's identity. In fact, she had spent the past several years living under a number of different fake names, so no one could figure out who she really was. This was a truly unique Jane Doe case, as there were several existing photographs of the victim, and a number of people who knew her personally, but all attempts to uncover her true identity were unsuccessful. Mercedes had shared a number of different stories about her background, such as her being in a witness protection program, but no one could verify if any of them were true. Well, in January of 2019, it was announced that there was a major breakthrough in this case when Jane Doe's DNA was uploaded to GEDmatch, and a hit was made which eventually led to an Alabama woman named Christina Tilford who had shared her own DNA with the website. Now here's where it gets interesting. Technically, Christina Tilford is Jane Doe's second cousin, but she has never met her and has no idea who she is. A genealogist would identify Jane Doe's biological father as being a descendant of a Virginia couple named Daniel Wood and Mamie Carter, who happened to be Tilford's great-grandparents and had 9 children of their own. The most prevalent theory seems to be that Jane Doe might have been conceived when one of the male members from that family fathered an illegitimate child, which would go a long way at explaining why it's been such a challenge to to figure out her true identity. Anyway, it's been nearly a year since this development was announced, and I can only assume that investigators are still attempting to put the pieces of the puzzle together. All we know is that the El Dorado Jane Doe does have a genetic link to this family, and if her biological father and mother can be identified, I'm sure this will fill in a lot of the gaps about her life. If all goes well, we'll be able to completely close the books on this case sometime this year, and like Deborah Jackson, we can finally start referring to this victim by her real name. Anyway, I now want to talk about one of the more recent cases I've featured on the podcast, the disappearance of 28-year-old Danielle Stislicki, who goes by the name Danny. On the evening of December the 2nd, 2016, Danny left her workplace in Southfield, Michigan, and was planning to meet her friend for dinner, but never showed up. The following day, Danny's Jeep was found parked at her apartment complex in Farmington Hills, but she was nowhere to be found. Only a few months after Danny went missing, I received a request to cover this case from a listener and decided to feature it on Minisode number 22, alongside an older unsolved missing persons case from Michigan, the 1990 disappearance of Paige Rankowski. I'm usually reluctant to take on cases which are less than a year old because the investigations are still very active and there could potentially be a major development at any moment, which is exactly what happened here. At the time I recorded the minisode, law enforcement was withholding a lot of key information from the public. They did reveal that a search had been performed at the home of a security guard from Danny's workplace, but they did not release his name. I mean, if you looked hard enough, you could find this man's name online, along with a bunch of rumors and gossip about him, but it would have been irresponsible to share any of that stuff on the podcast at that point. Well, in a crazy coincidence, the very day before the minisode's release, police announced that the security guard had been arrested and charged with attacking and attempting to sexually assault another woman in a park in Livonia just under 3 months before Danny went missing, and it wasn't long before the public learned that his name was Floyd Galloway Jr. In December of 2017, after pleading guilty to the charges of kidnapping, criminal sexual conduct assault with intent to commit sexual penetration, and assault with intent to do great bodily harm less than murder by strangulation, Galloway received a sentence of 16 to 35 years in prison. In spite of this, Galloway refused to speak about Danny's disappearance and always invoked his Fifth Amendment rights. But in March of 2019, he was finally charged with premeditated first-degree murder. Sadly, in spite of some extensive searches, Danny's body has still not been found, but prosecutors believe they have a strong circumstantial case against Galloway. In September, a preliminary hearing took place, and the judge ruled that there was enough evidence for Galloway to stand trial for murder. The trial is scheduled to take place sometime this year, and of course, I will keep you apprised of any updates. Anyway, before I talk about our next case, I want to take a few moments to talk about another true crime podcast which has covered Danny Stislicki's disappearance. You are listening to the Already Gone podcast, sharing stories of the missing, the murdered, the mysterious, and the lost. If you are a true crime podcast fan, you might already be familiar with those words, but if not, I'm here to tell you all about them. Already Gone is a podcast which launched shortly after The Trail Went Cold did, and has gone on to become one of the top entries in the genre. Many of its episodes have started out with those aforementioned words, delivered by one of the best voices in the business and a good friend of mine, Nina Instead. Over the past 4 years, Nina has produced over 100 episodes about both solved and unsolved crimes involving missing and murdered victims. In fact, many of these episodes cover lesser-known cases which ordinarily do not receive a lot of attention. Since Nina has lived most of her life in Michigan, she has a particular passion for stories from that state, such as the disappearance of Danny Stislicki. But even though this is a show which chronicles some disturbing and heartbreaking crimes, Nina always delivers these stories with the utmost compassion and respect, and is a major advocate for these victims. So if you haven't listened to it, I highly recommend you check out Already Gone on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever platform you use to listen to podcasts, or visit their website at alreadygonepodcast.com. And also be sure to check out Nina's other true crime show, Don't Talk to Strangers, a long-form podcast about the Oakland County child murders. Thanks for listening to this promo, and enjoy the rest of the episode. So now we're going to talk about another arrest which has recently taken place in a missing persons case, only this one occurred 43 years ago and happens to be one of the most famous cases in the history of Scotland. In November of 2016, I released episode number 21, which covered the disappearance of 36-year-old Renee McRae and her 3-year-old son Andrew, who both vanished after leaving on a road trip on November the 12th, 1976. Renee told people she was planning to go visit her sister, but later that night, her burning car would be discovered in an isolated lay-by located 12 miles away from her hometown of Inverness. Renee and Andrew were nowhere to be found, but blood which matched Renee's type was found on the vehicle's rug. Well, it turned out that Renee was not actually traveling to visit her sister, but had instead made arrangements to meet a man named Bill McDowell, who worked as an accountant at her husband's company. At the time, Renee and her husband were separated, and she had spent years carrying on a secret affair with Bill, who was married himself. But the biggest bombshell in the case was that Bill was actually Andrew's biological father. Bill admitted that he had been planning to spend the weekend with Renee, but canceled at the last minute, and never saw her or Andrew on the night they went missing. Since multiple quarries were located in relatively close proximity to the lay-by where the burning car was found, one of the most prevalent theories has been that Renee and Andrew's bodies were dumped in one of the quarries. Well, in June of last year, one of the quarries was drained, and some items were removed for forensic testing, including what appeared to be wheels for a pushchair. At the time he went missing, Andrew used a silver cross pushchair which disappeared alongside him, and its wheels were believed to be similar to the wheels found in the quarry. On September the 11th, only 2.5 months after this search, it was announced that Bill McDowell, who was 77 years old by this point, had been arrested and charged with the murders of Renee and Andrew, as well as 2 additional charges of attempting to pervert the course of justice. Bill has since been released on bail, and at the time of this recording, the remains of the 2 victims have yet to be found. Thus far, investigators have been very tight-lipped about what new evidence compelled them to make an arrest after all these years. We will probably not learn anything else until the next time Bill appears in court, but I will certainly keep you apprised of any further developments in this case. Well, thus far, I've discussed 3 missing persons cases in which a suspect has been arrested without a body, so now I'm going to talk about a case in which the victim's remains have been found, but we still don't know who murdered them. In January of 2017, I released Minisode number 11 about the disappearance of 12-year-old Janelle Matthews. On the evening of December 20th, 1984, Janelle sang in a choir in a Christmas concert in Greeley, Colorado, before she was dropped off at home by her friend's father. At the time, Janelle's mother was out of town, and her father and older sister were at a high school basketball game, but when they returned home, Janelle was not there, and the evidence clearly showed that she had been abducted. Well, over 34 years would pass before there were some answers about what happened to Janelle, and they would occur by complete chance. On July the 23rd, 2019, a construction crew were excavating the ground in a rural area about 15 miles from Janelle's home in order to install an oil pipeline. They were surprised to come across some skeletal remains, and within days, DNA testing positively identified the remains as belonging to Janelle Matthews. While investigators have not released any details about Janelle's cause of death, they are treating it as a homicide, and in September, they would announce a 68-year-old person of interest who is quite a unique character, to say the least. His name is Steve Pankey, and in 1984, he and his wife lived in Greeley, only 2 miles away from the Matthews residence. Pankey has since moved to Twin Falls, Idaho, and within the past 5 years, he has made 2 unsuccessful attempts to run for state governor. In the weeks following the discovery of Janelle's remains, 2 Greeley detectives traveled to Twin Falls to interview Pankey, but he refused to answer questions without an attorney and they would eventually get a probable cause warrant to search his residence. But even though Pankey has been reluctant to speak to law enforcement, he has not shown any hesitation about speaking to the media and maintaining his innocence. In fact, he even went so far as to record a 51-minute interview with KTVB-TV in Boise, and here are some of the most interesting pieces of information he shared. Pankey claims he never met Janelle or her family, and says that he and his wife were at home together on the night Janelle went missing. They then left at 5 a.m. the following morning on a trip to California to visit family for the holidays, and did not even learn about Janelle's disappearance until they returned home on December the 26th. Pankey admits that he had past brushes with the law while living in Greeley, including a rape charge from 1977, which was dismissed after Pankey maintained the sex was consensual. He seems to believe that the Greeley Police Department has always had a vendetta against him, which is why they are attempting to implicate him in Janelle's murder. There have also been conflicting accounts about Pankey's DNA, as Pankey claims that he has willingly given a DNA sample to the Greeley PD, but they maintain that they have never made any request to obtain DNA from him. Anyway, I can honestly say that I have no idea what to make of Pankey, as he seems to be all over the map whenever he talks about this case during interviews, but thus far, there doesn't seem to be any evidence that he even knew Janelle, let alone was responsible for her death. So we'll see if the investigation into him leads anywhere. At the very least, I'm glad Janelle's remains were finally recovered, and that her family was able to give her a proper burial, and hopefully, they will be able to witness her killer's arrest sometime in the near future. While we're on the subject of Janelle Matthews, you might recall that I briefly discussed another cold case on my minisode about her, and in a surprising turn of events, that particular case wound up being solved only 3.5 months later. During the minisode, I talked about a theory I had seen on Reddit that Janelle might have been an unidentified young woman known only as the Huntington Beach Jane Doe. She was killed on April the 1st, 1990, after being struck by two vehicles on the Pacific Coast Highway in Huntington Beach, California, but she carried no identification. However, there were a number of people who had interacted with this woman prior to her death, and she told some of them that her name was Andrea. Well, obviously, the Jane Doe was not Janelle Matthews, but there would finally be answers in May of 2017 when she was positively identified as 26-year-old Andrea Kuiper, who originally hailed from Fairfax, Virginia. This identification was not actually made through DNA, but came about when Jane Doe's fingerprints were uploaded to the FBI's automated fingerprint identification system. In 1987, Andrea Kuiper got a job with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which required her to provide her fingerprints on the application, and since those prints were entered into a government database, they wound up being matched to the Jane Doe. Andrea's family had not seen her since she left Virginia in 1989, and a few months before her death, a friend of hers called her parents to let them know Andrea was okay. After that, they completely lost touch with her and never filed a missing persons report. Andrea did have a history of manic depressive disorder and drug usage, so we'll probably never know the reasons for her making the lengthy cross-country trip to California, but at least her parents finally have answers about what happened to her, and Andrea has gotten her name back. Like I just mentioned, there is no connection between Janelle Matthews and Andrea Kuiper, but it is pretty remarkable that two completely unrelated cold cases that I featured on the same minisode have both gone on to have some sort of resolution. Anyway, now that we're on the subject of remarkable developments, I'm pleased to say that one of the oldest cold cases I've featured on the podcast also has some sort of resolution. In December of 2017, right before Christmas, I released episode number 51, which covered the very unique story of the Hatbox Baby. It involved a woman named Sharon Elliott who lived an ordinary life until she reached her mid-50s, when her dying mother suddenly revealed to her that she had been adopted. Not only that, but Sharon was adopted under the most unusual circumstances. On Christmas Eve in 1931, a couple named Ed and Julia Stewart were driving home when they suffered a flat tire in a remote desert area outside the town of Superior, Arizona. While Ed changed the tire, Julia wandered out into the desert and was surprised to come across a hatbox containing a newborn baby girl who had seemingly been abandoned there. After the child was turned over to the authorities, the story of the mysterious hatbox baby made national news until she was adopted out to a family less than 2 months later. For the next 5 decades, no one knew the hatbox's identity until Sharon Elliott learned this big secret from her adoptive mother and took her story public. Sharon now made it her mission to uncover the identities of her biological parents, and her story would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. Sadly, Sharon passed away on December 1st, 2018, at the age of 86, but months before she died, she finally learned the truth about her parents. One of Sharon's biggest advocates was John DeAnna, a reporter for the Arizona Republic, who worked on her story for 30 years and did tireless investigative work trying to uncover her true identity. On Christmas Eve last year, DeAnna published an extensive 10-part article revealing everything he found out. There's way too much material to cover here, so I'd advise everyone to track the article down, but here's the most important information. Not surprisingly, the identification of Sharon's birth parents was made possible by a genealogist named Bonnie Belza, who used Sharon's DNA to match her up with biological relatives. In the end, she was able to conclusively identify Sharon's birth parents as a couple named Walter Roth and Frieda Strackbein Roth. The Roths hailed from Davenport, Iowa, and got married on August 1, 1931, just under 5 months before the discovery of the hatbox baby. 2 years later, they had a son named James, who technically would have been Sharon's long-lost brother. By the time this discovery was made, Walter, Frieda, and James had all passed away, but Sharon was put in touch with a surviving relative named Emily Dodds Farrow, who happened to be Sharon's great-niece. Ironically, Emily had also been adopted and was searching for her own birth parents. Of course, while it was great that Sharon finally got to learn her family roots, this discovery now opened up a lot more unanswered questions and did not explain how a child born to a couple from Davenport, Iowa, wound up being discovered in a hatbox in Arizona. Well, if you listen to my podcast episode about this story, you'll know that there was a lot of skepticism about Ed and Julia Stewart's story, as it seems like quite an astronomical coincidence that they would have gotten a flat tire in the same isolated desert where a baby had just been abandoned. So a number of people believed that this whole thing was just a cover story, which the Stewarts fabricated, and that they always knew the identity of the child's mother. When you look at the timeline, the most logical theory is that Frieda was already pregnant with Sharon when she married Walter in August of that year, and the Ross did not want to reveal that they conceived a child out of wedlock, something which was a lot more scandalous back in 1931. John DeAnna was able to uncover an old newspaper article about the Ross's marriage, which mentioned that the couple was planning to travel westward for an extended period of time before they returned home to Davenport. So perhaps the Ross spent the next few months laying low in Arizona to cover up Frieda's pregnancy before she gave birth to Sharon, who somehow wound up in the hands of the Stewarts, who subsequently concocted their story about finding the baby in the desert. While no evidence has been uncovered to prove that the Ross and the Stewarts knew each other, John DeAnna has stated that he plans to keep investigating the story, so perhaps he will eventually uncover more information which sheds some light on the situation. Whatever the case, the most important thing is that Sharon finally got to learn the truth about her biological family before she passed away, and that's very satisfying because she always came across as one of the sweetest, kindest people ever during her interviews. But before we continue with the episode, I would also like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, HelloFresh, as we are very excited to have teamed up with America's number one meal kit. Did you know that the average trip to the grocery store takes 41 minutes? That's over 35 hours a year if you go once a week. And when you're as busy as I am producing weekly episodes for a true crime podcast, that's way too much time to be spent on shopping and food preparation. Well, HelloFresh allows you to save time and eat more sustainably. It cuts out stressful meal planning and prepping, so you can enjoy cooking and get dinner on the table in just about 30 minutes, or even 20 minutes with their quick recipe options. HelloFresh is flexible and fits your lifestyle, and you can easily change your delivery days, food preferences, and skip a week. It makes deliciousness part of every week, and HelloFresh has more 5-star recipes than any other meal kit, so you know you'll get something delicious. In fact, the other night, I enjoyed a tasty retro burger they sent me, which was topped with caramelized onions and accompanied by a delicious side of roasted sweet potatoes. It was a terrific dinner, which was very easy to prepare in only half an hour. HelloFresh is now $5.66 per serving. So go to HelloFresh.com/cold10 and use code COLD10 during HelloFresh's New Year's sale for 10 free meals, including free shipping. Once again, go to HelloFresh.com/cold10 and use code COLD10 during HelloFresh's New Year's sale for 10 free meals, including free shipping. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. So now we're going to talk about some cases I've covered, which are a long way from being solved, but have still had some interesting developments. In September of 2018, I released episode number 89, which featured 3 unsolved missing persons cases. One of them, which I covered at the request of a listener, involved the disappearance of 17-year-old Tracy Crow, who vanished after leaving her home in Dauphin County, Pennsylvania, on August 5th, 1989. The following day, Tracy's abandoned car was discovered in the town square in nearby Millersburg. Well, on August 8th, 2019, right after the 30th anniversary of Tracy's disappearance, the Pennsylvania State Police would make an arrest in this case, though it would not be for murder, but for perjury. At the time, a grand jury proceeding was taking place, and a 54-year-old local resident named Matthew Webster was called upon to testify. In August of 2016, police had performed a search of a property which once belonged to Webster. The following day, Webster met up with a woman named Holly Mallett, where he allegedly got drunk and made some incriminating remarks about how he and some friends had abducted Tracy from the Millersburg Town Square on the night she went missing, stating, quote, "It was just supposed to be a rape and done, but then it turned out to be a lot more than that," end quote. Years later, Mallett finally told police about Webster's statements, and they later received permission to tap Webster's cell phone. In June of 2019, Webster and Mallett had multiple phone conversations in which she told them she had been called upon to testify in front of a grand jury, so Webster provided her with instructions about what to say. When Webster testified under oath in August, he was asked if he had ever spoken to Mallett about the grand jury proceeding, and he denied it. But Webster was unaware that the police had recordings of their phone conversations together, and he was immediately arrested for perjury. Anyway, at the time of this recording, Webster is being held in Dauphin County Prison and cannot afford to post his $500,000 bail. His perjury trial is scheduled for February of this year, and if convicted, he could potentially face a 7-year sentence. But if Webster was telling the truth when he made those incriminating statements, and there were multiple people involved in Tracy's disappearance, then it will be interesting to see if his current legal problems might compel him to reveal more. Once again, I will keep you apprised of any further developments. So now we're going to travel across the Atlantic to Ireland and discuss the case I covered on episode number 61 in February of 2018. It involved the disappearance of 22-year-old Trevor Deely, who went missing during the early morning hours of December the 8th, 2000, while walking home from a Christmas party in downtown Dublin. This case is particularly creepy, since an ATM camera captured Trevor walking past a bank before he inexplicably vanished without a trace. In recent years, there have been rumors that Trevor may have crossed paths with someone from a criminal family who subsequently murdered him and disposed of his body. Acting on a tip, the Guard D performed a search of a wooded area in August of 2017, but it failed to turn up his remains. However, just last month, investigators announced that a new witness has come forward with more information which supports their theory that Trevor was murdered after an altercation with criminal figures. They have yet to disclose any specific details about what this witness revealed, but have described the witness as, quote-unquote, highly significant. So hopefully, this new information will lead to a significant break in the case sometime in the near future. Anyway, now I'm going to talk about a few developments in some cases I covered, which are a bit disappointing, to say the least. In December of 2016, I released episode number 22, which explored a harrowing crime that was featured on one of the earliest episodes of Unsolved Mysteries. It involved a violent attack on two women, Doreen Picard and Susan Laferte, who were both bludgeoned by a pipe inside the basement of an apartment house in Woonsocket, Rhode Island, on February the 19th, 1982. Doreen was killed, and Susan was left comatose, but while Susan eventually woke up and made a recovery, she claimed to have no memory of the attack and could not identify the perpetrator. Now, if you watch the Unsolved Mysteries segment on Amazon Prime or YouTube, you'll see a brief text update which states that a man named Raymond Beaver Tempest was convicted of Doreen's murder and has since been released, but that does not tell the whole story. In actuality, Tempest had his conviction vacated in July of 2015, and he was released from prison on house arrest until the state decided whether or not to retry him. If you want to hear the full convoluted story about this, listen to my original podcast episode, but most of the evidence against Tempest was unreliable eyewitness testimony, and there were multiple Brady violations committed by the prosecution at the original trial. I think there's a decent chance that Tempest did not actually commit this crime, but sadly, we'll probably never know for sure. After much legal wrangling between the two sides, there would not be a new trial, as Tempest agreed to enter an Alford plea in December of 2017, which allowed him to maintain his innocence while acknowledging that the state had enough evidence to convict him. So technically, Tempest is no longer on house arrest and is a free man again, though in the eyes of the law, he is still a convicted murderer and has not been exonerated. The Alford plea means that the case is now officially closed, so barring a surprise revelation of some sort, it's always going to remain up for debate whether the right man went to prison for the crime or if the real killer got away with it. And while we're on the subject of controversial convictions, let's talk about the Tommy Ziegler case, which, as I'm sure you know, has been one of my biggest passion projects. You probably all know what happened here. On Christmas Eve in 1975, four people were found murdered inside the Ziegler Furniture Store in Winter Garden, Florida, including Tommy's wife, Eunice Ziegler, her parents, Perry and Virginia Edwards, and a regular customer named Charlie Mays. Long story short, Tommy was found guilty and sentenced to death for all four murders, but the case has proven so controversial that Tommy's execution has never taken place. Tommy has always maintained his innocence, and after four decades, he is still languishing on death row at the age of 74. Well, last Christmas, a long-form investigative podcast was released about this case called Blood and Truth. It was hosted by Leonora LaPeter Anton, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist with the Tampa Bay Times, who did a deep dive into the story. Only a few weeks after the podcast's release, the 9th Judicial Circuit State Attorney's Office announced that their newly formed Conviction Integrity Unit was going to review Ziegler's case and determine whether or not he would be eligible for additional DNA testing, which had been denied to him by the state for the past two decades. But things did not go as Ziegler's supporters had hoped. Initially, the director of the Conviction Integrity Unit, Monique Haught Morel, expressed her belief that Ziegler received a quote-unquote less than fair trial, and recommended the testing, stating, quote, "If additional DNA testing can provide the closure of issues related to Mr. Ziegler's conviction, the state has a moral obligation to embrace the opportunity to show that they did it right," end quote. However, Haught Morel was soon replaced as the unit's director, and a replacement, Amanda Sempeo Bova, had a different opinion, expressing her belief that retesting the evidence would not lead to an exoneration, and that no further investigation was justified. Therefore, the state attorney's office rejected Ziegler's request for new DNA testing. Of course, the problem is that even though Bova made this decision sometime this past summer, she did not inform Ziegler's defense team about it, and they only learned of the decision when the Tampa Bay Times obtained documents and published a story on October the 18th. So yes, much like pretty much everything else in this case, the manner in which these events unfolded are highly suspect. For the moment at least, it looks like Tommy Ziegler will continue to remain on death row. So now we're going back to the very beginning of this podcast and talk about the case which was covered on only our second episode, the Fort Worth 3 disappearance. As you probably know, it involved three young girls, 17-year-old Mary Rachel Terlisa, 14-year-old Lisa Renee Wilson, and 9-year-old Julianne Mosley, who all went missing while making a trip to a shopping center in Fort Worth, Texas, 2 days before Christmas in 1974, and their abandoned car was found in the parking lot. It still remains one of the most baffling missing persons cases I've ever seen, but even after 35 years, efforts are still being made to solve it. In the fall of 2018, Rachel's younger brother, Rusty Arnold, helped raise funds for Operation Bring Them Up, an operation which involved volunteer divers searching for three sunken cars at the bottom of Benbrook Lake, located just outside Fort Worth. According to Rusty, they had received information which gave them reason to believe that one of these cars might be connected to the case. Over the course of two separate weekends, the operation managed to bring two of these sunken cars to the surface, and I even got to watch coverage of this unfold on Facebook Live. It doesn't look like either of these cars had any connection to the disappearances, and an attempt was made to bring the third car to the surface in September of 2019. Unfortunately, the vehicle was embedded underwater in some rocks, and whenever divers hooked up airbags in an attempt to raise it to the surface, the car would just break apart. It was ultimately decided that the effort to recover this vehicle was just too dangerous, so it will remain at the bottom of Benbrook Lake. I seriously hope that the bodies of the three missing victims are not inside that car, but given that the other two sunken vehicles had no significance to this case, my gut tells me that this one doesn't either. So the investigation is now back at square one, but the good news is that Operation Bring Them Up has kept the case in the spotlight, so here's hoping that these efforts lead to a significant development someday. Anyway, the case I featured on episode number 4 of this podcast was the strange death of 19-year-old Rhonda Hinson, who was killed while driving home from an office Christmas party in Burke County, North Carolina, on December the 22nd, 1981. Rhonda was fatally shot when a bullet from a high-powered rifle somehow managed to pass through the vehicle's trunk, backseat, and the driver's seat before it struck Rhonda in the heart. This case was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and while I can't say there have been any new developments in the actual investigation, a ton, and I mean a ton, of additional information has recently been made public. Let's just say that if there was one case from The Trail Went Cold which I would love to do an all-new episode about, it would be this one. I always used to believe that Rhonda's death was some sort of freak accident, as not even an expert marksman could make a fatal shot that perfectly. For this reason, I suspected that Rhonda was killed by a stranger who was playing around with a rifle that night, and the whole thing was a prank gone horribly wrong. However, last year, investigative reporter Larry J. Griffin published an extensive series of articles about the case for a Wilkes County newspaper called The Record, which pointed suspicion at Rhonda's controlling boyfriend. Of course, this took me by complete surprise, since the Unsolved Mystery segment never even mentioned this boyfriend. I would really like to go into more detail about this new revelation, but I wouldn't even know where to start, as this series of articles is currently on part 37, yes, 37, and I have no idea how much longer it's going to continue on. It's really an amazing piece of investigative journalism, so if you want to learn more about this, I'd recommend visiting the website, therecordandthursdayprinting.com. Like I just mentioned, one day I might record a new episode about Rhonda's case with all this additional information, but I want to wait until this series comes to an end, and who knows when that will be. Anyway, while we're on the subject of Unsolved Mysteries, I've provided numerous plugs on the show for the website, lostandfoundblogs.com, in which my friend Crystal Dawn writes extensive articles about cold cases, many of which were featured on Unsolved Mysteries. These articles will often contain exclusive information about the cases, which was not mentioned on the show, and the blog's most heavily covered mystery is probably the disappearance of Dale Kerstetter, who vanished after showing up to work the overnight shift as a security guard at the Corn and Glassworks plant in Bradford, Pennsylvania, on September the 12th, 1987. I covered Dale's disappearance on Minisode number 12 of the podcast nearly 3 years ago, but a pair of new articles from Lost and Found blogs have helped renew interest in the case, and it has since been covered in a couple of local newspapers. What's most interesting is that a website called mockrock.com decided to send a Pennsylvania Right to Know Act request to the Bradford Police Department in order to obtain the original surveillance tape from the Corning plant on the night Dale disappeared. You might recall how the surveillance footage showed Dale being accompanied through the plant by an unidentified masked intruder, but the Unsolved Mystery segment did not air the original tape and only presented a reenactment of it. Well, Mockrock finally convinced the police to send them a copy of the tape, and they posted the footage on their website, marking the first time it had ever been released publicly. Unfortunately, the quality of the original footage is so poor that it was impossible to make anything out, but some cleaned-up still photos have been posted on the most recent article about the case at Lost and Found blogs. Interestingly enough, these stills open up the possibility that two separate intruders may have been inside the plant and popped up on the footage at separate times that night, though this has never been conclusively proven. Anyway, feel free to visit the blog if you want to look at these stills and learn some additional information about Dale's case. Hopefully, this newfound attention might lead to answers someday. So I'm going to talk about one more case from Unsolved Mysteries. I'm sure that most of you are familiar with the unexplained death of Kurt Sova, a case I covered on episode number 30 in February of 2017. As a refresher, Kurt was a 17-year-old kid who went missing after allegedly getting drunk at a party in Newburgh Heights, Ohio, on October the 23rd, 1981. His body was discovered in a ravine 5 days later, but nobody was able to determine his exact cause of death. Sadly, both of Kurt's parents are now deceased, but surprisingly, this past November, the Newburgh Heights Police Department announced that they were reopening the investigation into his case. As you'll probably know if you heard my episode, the original investigation was badly mishandled, but the department is now partnering up with a criminal justice professor and a dozen students from Tiffin University in order to take a fresh look at the evidence. In fact, the case is going to be the subject of CrimeCon's next CrowdSolve event, which is taking place in Chicago next month from February the 21st to the 23rd. I gotta say, this whole situation was a very pleasant surprise. The case has become so dormant these past 3 decades that I never imagined there would be any more progress, but I saw Kurt's brother, Kevin Sova, speak at a press conference, and the family is still looking for answers, so it'll be interesting to see if this leads anywhere. Anyway, I'm now going to talk about an unsolved murder that was not one of our featured cases, but it was still discussed on the podcast as a mystery within a mystery. You might recall episode number 38 about the disappearance of Mary Shotwell Little, who vanished from Atlanta, Georgia under very bizarre circumstances on October the 14th, 1965. At one point, investigators explored the possibility that her disappearance might be connected to the murder of 22-year-old Diane Shields, who took Mary's job as a secretary at Citizens and Southern Bank after she went missing. By 1967, Diane had gotten a new job, but after leaving her workplace on May 19th, she was found dead in the trunk of her own car several hours later. She had been suffocated with a scarf, and a page from a phone book was shoved down her throat. Diane's best friend would claim that Diane had told her she was working undercover with the police to help them solve the disappearance of a woman named Mary, and while no evidence was ever found to corroborate this, there was speculation that this case was connected to Mary Shotwell Little's disappearance. The murder has still never been solved, but this past October, noted crime scene analyst Cheryl McCollum, director of the Cold Case Investigative Research Institute, expressed her belief that she knows who Dian Shields' killer is, and that he's still alive and living in Atlanta. According to McCollum, this person was an acquaintance who became infatuated with Dian, but Dian was already engaged at the time, and the perpetrator may have responded to her rejection by committing murder. This person has sent numerous emails to law enforcement, which have been reviewed by McCollum and several analysts, and they are convinced that the writer has legitimate knowledge of Dian's murder. While McCollum does not believe this case is actually connected to Mary Shotwell Little, if they apprehend Dian's killer and solve the crime, this could eventually open the pathway to solving Mary's disappearance. Okay, and last but not least, we will close off this episode by talking about another cold case from Georgia, the disappearances of Danette and Jeanette Millbrook. As you probably know, Danette and Jeanette were a pair of 15-year-old African-American twin sisters who vanished without explanation from Augusta on March 18, 1990. The Richmond County Sheriff's Office would write off the twins as runaways and inexplicably close the case on their 17th birthday. They then proceeded to ignore the twins' family for the next two decades before newly elected Sheriff Richard Roundtree announced that he was reopening the investigation in 2013. But unfortunately, law enforcement then went back to completely ignoring the family again. In May of 2016, the true crime podcast Thin Air released an episode about the twins' story, which featured an interview with their younger half-sister, Shantae Sturgis. Shortly thereafter, I was contacted by a listener who asked if I would feature this case on The Trail Went Cold and put me in touch with Shantae. Of course, I found this story so outrageous that I decided to cover it on episode number 12, which came out in July. Well, about a year later, I was contacted by an Atlanta woman named Laura Norton, who informed me that she was teaming up with her friend, Brooke Hargrove, to put together a long-form investigative true crime podcast called The Fall Line. Their goal was to put the spotlight on cold cases, which received very little attention, and their first season would cover the Millbrook twins. Well, long story short, their efforts wound up garnering more coverage for this case than it had ever seen before, and this past November, the Oxygen Network aired a two-hour TV special titled The Disappearance of the Millbrook Twins. Needless to say, back in 2016, I don't think I ever would have envisioned this case getting its own two-hour TV special, which shows you just how effective the Fall Line was at spreading awareness. During the show, the biggest piece of new information came from a convicted murderer named Ernest Vons, who is currently serving a life sentence at Dodge State Prison. Vons has a connection to the twins' estranged father, John Millbrook, who has always been very indifferent about finding out what happened to Danette and Jeanette. John even spent time in prison for helping Vons get rid of the body of a man he killed. 2 years ago, the makers of the Fall Line received a letter from Vons, who claimed that he knew what happened to the twins, but when the letter was passed on to the Richmond County Sheriff's Office, they proceeded to ignore the lead. So during the TV special, a pair of private investigators named Laura Coates and Paige Reynolds interviewed Vons via telephone, and he finally shared the whole story. He claimed that on the day they went missing, Danette and Jeanette ended up at their father's house, which was known for being a place that drug dealers used to conduct their operations. According to Vons, there were about 8 or 9 men at the house when one of the twins got intoxicated and the men tried to take advantage of her. When the other twin tried to intervene, one of the men struck her, causing her to fall back and bust open her head on a table. Vons said he was told to leave the house, but he could hear the twins screaming as he left, and while he did not personally witness what happened to them, he theorized that their bodies may have been buried somewhere in Augusta's Mary Brothers Brickyard. Vons provided the street names of some of the people who were allegedly at John Millbrook's house that night, and once again, this information was given to the Richmond County Sheriff's Office, who proceeded to assign some investigators to look into Vaughn's story. But here's the really odd part. Even though these investigators believed that parts of Vaughn's story sounded credible, they also believed that there are enough discrepancies that they theorized that Vaughn's might have actually been referring to an entirely different crime which did not involve the Millbrook twins. As a result, they've decided not to pursue this lead any further. Okay, I'm not going to go off on a rant here, but I will say that there are serious red flags with this response. If the investigators had said that Bonds was lying and flat out made up the story, that would be one thing. But what exactly is this other crime he was supposed to have witnessed? Did two completely different twin girls just happen to get killed at a house belonging to the father of two other missing twin girls? I can't even begin to imagine the logic behind the sheriff's office's response, but I won't speculate here. I'll just say that in spite of all these new developments, I continue to remain just as frustrated with the investigation today as I was 3.5 years ago. Regardless, I will continue to direct all the praise in the world to the Fall Line podcast for bringing so much attention to this case, and since we're rapidly approaching the 30th anniversary of Danette and Jeanette's disappearance, I truly hope that the twins get justice and their family receives conclusive answers someday. Anyway, that about brings an end to our special Trail Went Cold update episode, and after hearing about all these new developments, I guess you could say, the trail went hot. Another special thanks to Gunya D. O'Horn for reading the opening narration on today's episode and for being such a huge fan of the podcast. Like I mentioned in the intro, Dio happens to be the host of her own podcast, Coffee with My Ma. Dio is a Mohawk actress, and she describes her podcast as an invitation into her mother's kitchen for frank conversations about life as an outspoken indigenous woman surviving the 20th century. Dio's mother was, and still is, a powerful voice in indigenous activism across Turtle Island, and she has passed that passion as global awareness and justice for her people to her four daughters, including Dio. With titles like Ma Steals Larry the Cree Baby, Surviving the 60s Scoop, Ma's Life is Saved by Her Full-Length Faux Fur Coat, the Police Brutality episode, and Ma Clears the Air About Marlon Brando, the podcast is kept light and fun, but can definitely touch on heavier subjects. You can find Coffee with My Ma on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, and please follow on Twitter and Facebook at Coffee with My Ma, and on Instagram at Coffee with My Ma Podcast. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, we covered a story which was featured on the very first episode of Unsolved Mysteries involving a woman named Pat Mielbach and her attempts to find out if she was the biological daughter of automobile manufacturing pioneer John Francis Dodge. And for our patrons in tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. Once again, I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. Like I mentioned earlier, when I started this podcast nearly 4 years ago, I thought it would be cool if maybe one or two of the cold cases I covered might be solved someday, but needless to say, the way things have gone have greatly surpassed my expectations. I did not envision that we would reach the point where I would have enough material for this lengthy update episode. But I think this just demonstrates that we have entered a new era when it comes to cold case investigations, and that any mystery, no matter how old, now has the potential to be solved. So once again, I want to wish everyone a happy new year, and here's hoping that we have a lot more major developments in these cases in 2020. If all goes according to plan, maybe we'll be able to kick off 2021 with another update episode just like this one. So I hope everyone has themselves a good week, and join us next Wednesday as we return to our regular format and present a brand new episode about another cold case on The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.